13 years old. You are a teenager and you're as good as gold. Ricky Baker, oh. Ricky Baker, happy birthday. Once rejected, now accepted by me and Hector, we're a trifecta.
So I discovered this film during COVID, and I feel like I just wanted to watch something that I could, A, get kind of lost in, that it was immersive and like visually interesting, and then B, that, you know, had humor. I feel like I really wanted to watch funny things in the beginning of COVID. And then, you know, as I was watching it, or after I watched it, actually, I started thinking about the ways in which America shows up in the movie. And I'm just interested in the way America is experienced in other places in the world. So that kind of struck me as well.
Welcome to Open Form. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. As an orphan who has spent years in the system finally starts to adjust to the last family that will take him in, tragedy strikes, and he finds himself, along with a reluctant father figure, the subject of a manhunt through the New Zealand bush. This week's film is Hunt for the Wilder People, and it was chosen by Nadia Owusu, the Whiting Award-winning author of the recently released memoir, Aftershocks.
The sort of child protective services officer and then the cop, they seem very sort of bought into and excited about the American policing system. And almost like all of their behavior is down to sort of reading Miranda rights, which then a character very kind of humorously says, you know, we don't read Miranda rights here. That's an American thing. But it's like they have been watching Cops or something and they aspire to that. And then I thought that that was, I mean, I know that the New Zealand justice system also has a racism problem, but it seems like the racism problem is modeled on the American racism problem, which I found interesting. And then also the protagonist, Ricky, and just his fascination with hip hop and sort of the posturing that he does around hip hop, which having grown up in different places in Africa and Europe, I saw a lot. And so I was just very interested in that too.
He hurt you, son?
Nah. I fell in some prickles one time.
He pushed you in those prickles?
Yeah, probably.
Did he push you in the prickles, mate?
Leave him alone.
You shut your trap, old fella. I'd go get some rest if I was you. You got a long walk tomorrow.
First of all, you watch how you talk to me. And second of all, you can take him, but I'm staying here.
Like hell. People want answers.
On that first point, thinking about this sort of export of American policing or American style policing, and thinking of conversations that we've been having here in this country over the past, almost a year or so, sparked by last summer and the killing of George Floyd and the protests that then emerged from that. And then the discussion that happens around like the abolition and defunding of police and people looking for alternatives. But then it opens up to this larger conversation around like the ways in which policing has, the very concept of policing has infected all of these different systems, and all of these institutions operate as essentially arms of the police. And thinking about child protective services, the character in here, I think her name is Paula. Yeah, you're right. Like very much into that mode of like American violence and policing. Like she calls herself Terminator at one point.
I'll never stop running.
Yeah, and I'll never stop chasing you. I'm relentless. I'm like the Terminator.
I'm more like Terminator than you.
I said it first. You're more like Sarah Connor.
No, I'm not.
Yes. In the first movie too, before she could do chin-ups.
But then thinking about Child Protective Services itself, just as an institution, as another arm of the criminal legal system, right? Like what Ricky, the child protagonist, is afraid of at this point. You know, he's an orphan. He's been through the system, and he's been taken to different foster families over and over again, and he's like at his last chance. And then, you know, the woman who adopts him, Bella, she passes away, and he's left with Heck, her husband, who was reluctant or just disinterested the entire time. But, you know, now they're coming to take Ricky away again, and he's like, I don't want to go because I know what the next thing is, and it's juvie. And it's just like, you know, he's being shuttled through all of these different systems, and it's all containment, and it's all a matter, and, you know, Paula, the Child Protective Services employee, she constantly says, no child left behind, another, you know.
Right,
like
she
says it as a threat, right? Like the idea that, you know, this what should seem like a like benevolent sort of idea of no child left behind is really just another way of policing. Like it's played for comedy, but like she runs down like his list of you know infractions and things, and she's. She really harps on the spitting thing,
yeah.
And it just and it's just like, you know, these are like pretty innocuous in some of them, but then like, you know, just sort of childlike behavior in a lot of ways. But you know, he has to be policed in this way.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of stood out to me too, the no child left behind thing, because, you know, American policy really does have such a huge impact around the world. And, you know, I've recently been kind of digging into even deeper the ways in which aid policy, aid development, foreign development, aid policy kind of shifts the ways that governments in the developing country actually kind of implement policy. And that kind of stood out to me as well, the fact that she was using No Child Left Behind as a threat. And the reality that in many ways, you know, Child Left Behind, the policy itself, was threatening to a lot of children. And so, yeah, I think it was sort of played for laughs. And at the same time, I think was kind of making a bigger statement about the way that sort of harmful and violent American systems and policies kind of spread their tentacles around the world.
You didn't even have a map. Who's on map?
Don't need one. I know where I am.
Probably couldn't even read it anyway.
Why would I need to read a map? I already told you I know where I am. Reading's stupid anyway.
Only people who can't read say things like that.
And then the second thing that you mentioned, like this export of American culture, and it's specifically Ricky's engagement with like Black American culture, right? Like, and I found it like this really tender moment. Like it's not that, like, I get that it, in the sort of universe of the film, it's kind of meant for you to laugh at a little bit, but it also it's a little you know, he's lying in bed, and he's trying to figure out a name for his dog. He's gotten a dog for his 13th birthday, and he mentioned Tupac, which he eventually names the dog Tupac, and he says, you know, Bella's like, who's Tupac or what's a Tupac? And he's like, this really cool rapper. He's like my best friend. Yeah. And, you know, it's like that sort of childlike thing of like attaching to certain cultural products or like, you know, or things in that, like, you know, this is a person that Tupac was killed before this child was ever born, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I also found it to be really interesting in this idea that it's encompassing the film or runs throughout, in which it's like the communing with the dead, right? Like, Bella dies and he's carrying her ashes and like wanting to get her to the mountain in the bush, you know, but the idea that he says it's not just a cool rapper, right? Like, and it's not just someone that he wishes would have been his friend. He, like, Tupac is his best friend.
Yeah.
He's with him in that way, you know, like, and this idea of death not being final, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bella kind of introduces that, you know, when she says that there's a river up in the mountains, I think it is, where all of the souls of their people, and they're Maori, the Bella and Ricky. And also, interestingly, the Child Protective Services woman and the cop, I think, are also Maori. Heck is white. But so she says that, you know, our souls go up to the mountain, to the river, and that's where our souls can be found. And so I don't know much about Maori culture, but it seems as though they do have sort of a connection to ancestors, and sort of ancestors being present still in people's lives. And so I also found that really interesting that he had sort of latched onto Tupac as being sort of present in his life to the extent that he was his best friend and sort of protector, and he saw him as sort of someone that he could, you know, and it was played for laughs too, but sort of aspire to in some ways, because he needed to kind of create this tough persona. And, you know, Ricky is definitely not tough. He tries to run away multiple times, but immediately comes back so he can have pancakes, you know. but he sort of he postures and he puts on this persona. And yeah, I think there was something sort of sweet and tender about it. And then he ultimately, yeah, he names the dog Tupac. And he arrives sort of in this rural area. And I think he came from a city, but he arrives wearing this All Eyes on Me jacket.
That's the moment I was hooked. I was like, okay, I'm in on that.
Yeah.
How many bullets do we have?
Ricky, we gotta stop.
Never! Come on!
Mate, this is it for me. Look, I can't go on anymore. My leg's buggered. I can hardly see. This is the end.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And you mentioned that posturing, and it's very interesting to then think about that in terms of hip hop culture and Tupac specifically, right? Like Ricky, by virtue of his upbringing, needs or feels like he needs a level of toughness, a hard shell to protect himself from all of these things. Like, now he's been given different tools, right? Like he's been like, oh, when I process my feelings, I'm like writing a haiku, right? Yeah. Like,
and his haiku is like, I hope he dies a painful death or something like that. That's how it
ends. Yeah. But it's like, it's that connection between like oppressed peoples globally, right? Like the export being Black American, specifically hip hop, that's drawn from that experience and a means of escaping, a means of articulating, a means of shouting at the world, right? And that, you know, when people see those outward expressions that they then become the markers of criminality, right? Like, you know, his sneakers, the way he wears his hoodies and all of that stuff, right? Like, now these become markers of an outlaw, essentially. But what the outlaw is born of this sense of displacement.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think going back to the point you were making earlier where Ricky tells Heck, you know, when Heck is considering sending him back and he said there's no more homes, just juvie, they don't care about kids like me. You know, they just move us around. And, you know, and then there's this moment later where he tells Heck about his friend Amber, who was a child like him, who was an orphan child who, you know, we learn kind of died due to neglect and abuse in the foster care system. And so, you know, thinking about the relationship between oppressed people and these kind of systems, the prison system, which, you know, this film is sort of arguing, I think, that the Child Protective Services is often a part of. And also considering that that's like, it's also, those are also colonial systems, you know? And so I think in some ways, you know, I was thinking about too, having grown up in Africa, the ways in which I also, you know, when I was a teenager, I knew a lot of sort of young African boys who wanted to be Tupac or, and would have loved to have Tupac be their best friend, because I think that there is a way that, the solidarity, among oppressed people and the language of hip hop allows young people around the world to sort of speak to the oppressive systems that are all connected globally.
Stop the truck. I want to get out now.
I didn't choose the skunk's life. the scars I chose me.
Ricky, stop.
At its core, though, this film really is just like a buddy comedy, right? Yes. Like, so you've got heck this old curmudgeonly man who just has no interest in Ricky whatsoever and is sort of left with him after Bella's death. And, you know, they're like, he wants no part of this responsibility, and it feels like he's just like, I want to say, like, it's just that life is worn on him. He's also a product of this prison and policing system, right? And he mm-hmm. says he went to prison. He got in a drunken bar fight when he was younger and went to prison for manslaughter. And so it's like when they're two of them together, right, like, it's now this means of looking at, like, who are the disposable people, right? Like the way that, you know, the New Zealand police force descends upon these two people.
With tanks. It's, yeah.
Right?
So crazy.
Right. It's a manhunt for two people, and they've called in basically an army, right?
Yeah.
But it's asking, who do we find worthy of care? And, you know, Bella's the only one in their lives that has offered them that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Kath even says, you know, that's what she did. She took in mm-hmm. strays like us. And it is a comedy at its heart. You know, it is this sort of buddy film. And it also kind of, I think, connects back to a lot of orphan films, you know, like Annie. It's like the sort of reluctant guardian, I think. But you know, it sort of blows that up as well into this sort of high stakes chase that, mm-hmm. you know, takes up most of the film, where they are inadvertently on the run from the law.
Yeah.
Because, again, Ricky does sort of run away and Heck goes to find him, but then gets injured. And then, you know, the police show up and think that Heck is trying to steal the child, mm-hmm. that they really just want to put in juvie.
Right.
You know, but yet they're going to chase them with tanks through the bush. And, you know, we see so much beauty in the wilderness of New Zealand. And I also really liked that about the film too, is like they go into the wilderness, and in some ways, although, you know, Heck does get injured, but the wilderness does offer them protection that Ricky especially might not have, elsewhere. And I think that also sort of connects to the ways in which Indigenous people, you know, have been sort of displaced, and sort of the joy that they find in sort of reconnecting with the bush.
Yeah, like back to the land, you know,
yeah,
and it's exactly. Very much, yeah.
Come out and get over the boy,
Uncle, they're close!
Sam, what's the fastest way out of here?
Jetpack!
Do you actually have a jetpack?
No! What? Wait, I've got an underground bunker! This tunnel leads directly to an underground chamber! I haven't dug it yet.
I also was just, I was like, I am Ricky in the beginning, because it's like, you know, like, because I am not a nature person by any means. He's like, you know, I got poop on my kicks. I'm like, look, that would have ended it there for me. I would have actually run away. And like, Bella's like doing stuff with the animal and like plops one down on the table. And it's like, yeah, you pick the fur off. I'm like, I'm not touching that animal.
Yeah, and I think Heck at some point asks him if he's going to be able to help on the farm at all, or if he's purely ornamental.
Yeah.
Which I found very funny.
I'm like, yes, yes, yeah. I am totally. I got nothing for you.
In
I got nothing
to offer. In the context of the bush, I am ornamental.
But he learns. He learns, and I think that like it's. I don't know how to feel in terms of it. Like, I think that there's like this connective tissue of the two of them being like unwanted, like unloved, and losing the one connection that they have to that very real human emotion and desire. You know, obviously affects Heck of like emotionally more than it does Ricky. But you know that. I did, like, I wondered, because I don't have enough context for, like, the sort of racial stratification of New Zealand, of, like, what does it mean to look at this older white man with this younger Maori boy? And, like, are we essentially at, like, I wondered, like, how much of it am I looking at and just seeing simply, or am I seeing this attempt to say that these people have more in common than, mm-hmm. like, than they would presume, or am I looking at some type of, like, reluctant white saviorhood?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I'm not sure either. Mm. You know, I think certainly with the history of colonization, I think that there were, or I can see some elements of white saviorism. Mm. I think that it is complicated by the fact that Heck is also sort of, as you said, sort of a discarded person. Mm. But it was still there. I did have questions about that as well, especially because Ricky then does come into contact. I mean, Bella is Maori as well, and then he does come into contact with the little girl and her father. And I did wonder, could the Heck character have been Maori? Like, why the choice to make him white? Yeah, so I don't know. I was interested in that, too.
Yeah, it's a curious choice, I would say. But it was, you're right in picking this as, like, just a funny movie. It's bit, like, I've only actually seen of Taika Waititi's movies before this. I had only seen Thor, just because it's a Marvel movie, and Jojo Rabbit. But, like, I was like, no, that comedic sensibility is just running through everything that I've seen from him. Like, that ability to sort of capture these very offbeat moments and, like, to play for comedy, like, our sense of culture as precious, but mm-hmm. to like ask us, like, why we consider that.
I think that was one of the things that I found so delightful about this movie. You know, there were, you know, the story itself, as you're kind of speaking to, in terms of, you know, the kind of curmudgeonly older man, in this case, also a white man, which I think probably that story has been told a lot too. Mm-hmm. But you know, kind of becoming the guardian to an orphan. And then also, so I think it's combining sort of the orphan, maybe an orphan trope. And then also a buddy, you know, comedy, but there's something about the characters that makes it work and makes it different. And, you know, the story itself is very familiar. But it's just so grounded in these, like, wonderful little moments between the characters that I think make it stand out and sort of disarm you and, like, keep you engaged.
Nadia, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from Hunt for the Wilder People?
So there's this one point, it's after Bella has died and they've just left this ridiculous funeral. And they're driving back to the farm, Ricky and Heck, and they're in the car. And, you know, again, we get this lovely shot of the New Zealand kind of bush landscape, on this sort of secluded road on their way back to the farm where they live. And then the car sort of pauses. Sort of in the middle of the road. And, you know, I was wondering, did the car break down or what's going on? But in some ways, it just sort of marked the transition to part two of the movie, which is the world without Bella. And I just really appreciated that moment. Just sort of the kind of pause to take in the landscape, but then also to consider that these characters' lives are about to change enormously.
Nadia, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Open Forum, a podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Justin Alvarez and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Forum wherever you get your podcast, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episodes. Next week, is Robert Townsend a great American filmmaker, or is he the greatest American filmmaker?